Please take a seat. Our reading this evening is from Daniel chapter 3. I tend to find Daniel's a rather elusive book in the Bible, and you'll find the reading on page 894. That's 894, and we will be reading the whole chapter. Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates and all the officials in the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning, fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair on their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies, rather than serve and worship any god except their own. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Well, please do keep the passage open. Daniel 3, it was on page 894. And you may find the outline helpful as well. In the year 1460 BC, one of the pharaohs had a couple of tall stone monuments erected in the Egyptian city of Heliopolis. Almost 1500 years later, so in about 12 BC, the pair were moved by the Romans to the city of Alexandria to stand in front of a temple there. The pair weren't to move again until the 19th century AD, when they were finally separated. One of them found a home in Central Park, New York, and the other one was almost lost at sea in a storm. It cost the lives of five sailors trying to rescue it before finally it came to rest at the place where it now stands today on the embankment beside the Thames, commemorating the British victory over Napoleon. And both monuments share the same name. They are each known as Cleopatra's Needle. Now, if ancient monuments are your thing, you're in for a real treat this evening, because Daniel 3 is a true story about another ancient monument. It was one that was erected in Babylon about 900 years after the ones in Egypt. So if you found that story of Cleopatra's Needle fascinating, you've come to the right place, and I can already detect a rising sense of anticipation in the room. But it may just be that there are one or two here this evening who couldn't care less about ancient monuments, in which case you'll be relieved to learn that Daniel chapter 3 is not just an entry from an old copy of Baedeker's Guide to Babylon or from the Lonely Planet Guide to the Ancient Near East. There's a lot more to this story than that. This is the word of God for God's people in exile then and in exile now today. And chapter 3 contains both a challenge and a reassurance. And there's also plenty of food for thought in this chapter for those who wouldn't yet count themselves as servants of the Lord. Firstly then, the challenge. The challenge, as you'll see from the outline there, is to be faithful to the Lord. To be faithful to the Lord. What does being faithful to the Lord involve? What does it look like being faithful to the Lord as his servants? Well, you'll see we're going to look at a couple of hallmarks. Firstly, being faithful to the Lord involves a refusal to serve other gods. So verse 1 of the chapter began, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, the reason I began with Cleopatra's Needle was to give you a point of comparison so you've got some idea of the dimensions of this monument that the king set up. So the needle on the embankment, which you're all familiar with, is about 60 feet high and about 6 feet wide. Well, King Nebuchadnezzar's monument here is about 90 feet high and about 9 feet wide. Okay, so it's a little bit taller and a little bit wider than the needle on the embankment. but the same sort of proportions, if you've got that in your mind. It was made of gold, presumably gold-plated, rather than granite, like the needle. And it's described here as an image. Yeah, it's described as an image of gold. So whether it was an image of the king, or maybe of some god, we're not told. If it was an image of the king, he would have looked like a very stretched out version of Peter Crouch, if you're into football. So it wouldn't have been the most flattering representation if you imagine the king in the shape of the needle on the embankment. But anyway, there we go. What the needle was originally used for on the embankment, we're not too sure. But the function of this golden image is very clear, isn't it? It was religious. So a dedication ceremony is organised in verse 2, at which all the peoples are commanded, in verse 5, to fall down and worship the golden image. So clearly religious. Now the heroes of this true story, the heroes this time are not Daniel, but Daniel's three friends, who are mentioned in verse 12, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they refuse to play ball at the dedication service. Why? Well, the king refers to them in verse 26, doesn't he, as servants of the Most High God. What is one of the marks of being a servant of the Most High God? Well, servants of the Most High God refuse to serve any other god. That is one of their characteristics. So you see that, for example, in verse 12. In the words of these guys who rat on the friends to the king, they say in verse 12, "These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." You see it as well in what the friends themselves say when they're brought before the king in verse 18. So verse 18, they say, "Be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." And you see it as well in the words of the king himself in verse 27, when he declares that they yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own god. Well, if you would call yourself a servant of God this evening, do you have this same hallmark? It's important to understand that the position of these friends is fundamental to biblical religion. So it's not exceptional, it's very normal in the Bible. It's not an extra fakinis, it's basic. Serving the Lord means not serving other gods. That conviction is right at the heart of a biblical understanding of what it means to be a servant of the Lord. This understanding of what it means to be a servant of the Lord, it comes right from the top, doesn't it? It comes from God himself. In fact, it's so axiomatic that God devoted the first two of his Ten Commandments to making the point, didn't he? So he said, "I'm the Lord your God." Commandment one was what? "You shall have no other gods before me." Commandment two, "You shall make for yourself, you shall not make for yourself a carved image. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." Well, what's behind that? What underpins these commands is the reality that the Lord is the only true God. So serving other gods, it's just laughable, isn't it? It's ridiculous. Indeed, the story here in chapter 3 makes fun of those who serve other gods. And I wonder if you caught that as it was being read to us. It came out through the repetitions in the story. It's really making fun of worshipping other gods. So, for example, verse 2 refers to the image that the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And that is repeated time and again, that phrase, that it's just something that he's made. It comes up twice in verse 3, comes up in verse 5 and verse 7. Or in verse 2 there, you've got this long list of officials who attend the ceremony. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province and the court of King Caractacus and all. It's that sort of stuff, isn't it? Why repeat all those names in verse 3? Similarly, the long list of instruments that we had in verse 5, which give the signal to bow down to the image. Why repeat them in verses 7, 10, 15? Well, the point is simply to make fun of the whole thing. It's laughable. And you can just imagine the Jews laughing as this story was retold time and again in the synagogue over the years to come. But the story of the three friends was intended to be a challenge to God's people in exile. Be servants of the Lord like them, like the three friends. Don't serve other gods. Serve the Lord alone. Serving other gods, it's ridiculous. It's laughable. In fact, it's pathetic. So don't do it. But they had done it. They had done it, hadn't they? In fact, it was their failure to serve the Lord alone that had landed them up in exile in the first place. And this story was a call to change. It was a call to be the people God had intended. Well, the story challenges us as well, doesn't it? To make sure that we have this basic hallmark of the servants of the Lord. That is to say that we serve the Lord alone and we refuse to serve other gods. You're probably thinking, what does that mean in our situation today? Few of us here, I imagine, if we call ourselves Christians, few of us here will feel tempted to go off and to worship the God of Islam or the gods of Hinduism or whatever. And there's no pressure from the authorities in this country to do so. However, there is definitely pressure in our culture to subscribe to the view that all paths, all religions are equally valid and they're all equally right. People call it different things, don't they? They call it pluralism or relativism or tolerance. Whatever you call it, it wouldn't be going too far to say that that is now the state religion. Is that not true? It is the state religion. So this is the gold image before which we are commanded to bow. It's this attitude that it's fine for you, what you're doing, you do your own thing, but don't dare to make out that that is the only way and the only right way. Don't dare to make out that other people are wrong. If you do that, that's showing disrespect. You need to be tolerant. Instead, it's stirring up hatred and so on. Well, this relativism, this tolerance, is certainly one of the golden images in our culture, which we are told we must bow before. But if we're servants of the Lord, we have to remain on our feet. So the story challenges us not to compromise, not to compromise our convictions in a multi-faith culture. But there is more to it than that. If we think of gods purely in terms of religions, the Bible would say we're thinking far too narrowly. An idol, a false god, is simply anything which takes the place of the Lord in our lives. So our God is what we are ultimately serving in our lives. It's what controls the way that we think. It's what controls the way that we act. It's what is the focus of our dreams and our hopes. That is our God. So you'll remember Jesus warns in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, that you cannot serve God and money. He's saying, isn't he, that there are two gods there which are competing and you've got to choose which one you go for. Similarly, Paul says in Colossians 3, verse 5, that covetousness or greed is idolatry. It is making material things your God before whom you bow down. So an idol, it could be something tangible in our lives like money, material things and pursuing that. But an idol could equally be something intangible. For example, it could be the fear of other people. The fear of other people could be a god in our lives. So if my overriding concern in life is what other people think of me, other people's opinion of me, if that is so how they will treat me, the fear of others has become my god. So if that shapes how I live, that fear of others has become the god in my life. So if, for example, tomorrow morning you refuse to say that you've been to church on a Sunday when someone asks what you got up to at the weekend, if you do that because you're afraid of what they'll think of you, then the fear of others has become a god in your life. It's controlling you. For other people, it is their feelings which is their god. So how they feel determines what they will do and what they will not do. And such people tend to be reluctant to commit to anything. Whether it's diary dates or whether it's relationships, they won't commit. Why? Well, because they don't know how they will feel when it comes around. They're ruled by the mandate of the emotions. And for all of us at root in all of our lives, the idol lurking in the shadows is simply me. It's the self, isn't it? Well, we could go on, but being a servant of the Lord means serving him alone and refusing to serve other gods, whether they're religious gods or some of the secular gods. And so this story calls us to repentance and calls us to a renewed commitment to the Lord. It calls us not just to take a stand against relativism in our multi-faith society, but it also calls us to examine ourselves and to smoke out the gods which may be lurking within in our own hearts. The gods in our hearts, serving whom is just as ridiculous, it's just as pathetic as bowing down before a golden image. It would be ironic, wouldn't it, if we were people who were very outspoken about the uniqueness of Christ in a multi-faith society, but at the same time we had another God on the throne of our lives that we were serving, whether it was money or popularity or success or our image or fear or lust or whatever. It would be ironic, wouldn't it? And it would be hypocritical as well. But it is a real danger for all of us, isn't it? It's a danger that while we're guarding the front door of our lives, there's a danger that the enemy sneaks in the back door while we're doing that. The final words of the letter of 1 John have wide-ranging application. Little children, keep yourselves from idols, he says. So the first hallmark of the servant of the Lord is this refusal to serve other gods. The second one is resolving to count the cost. Resolving to count the cost. The three friends here are committed to serving the Lord alone, regardless of the cost, even though it means going against the flow and going into the flames. Firstly, going against the flow. After the king had set up his golden image, he sends out the invitations to the dedication service. The invitations in verse 2 go out to all the officials of the provinces. Now, by invitation, we mean not, would you like to come to the king's party sort of thing, but rather, make sure you're at the dedication service or else. It's that sort of invitation. So it's more of a command. The big day arrives. Verse 3, then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the councillors, the treasurers, the justices, blah, blah, blah. They stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. All the important people are there. The bigwigs, they're all there. And you can picture the scene. You've got thousands of people standing on this plain before this image of gold, shoulder to shoulder. Then the moment comes. At the sound of the music in verse 7, everyone falls flat on the ground, bowing down before this statue. Verse 7 emphasizes that everyone does it. So as soon as all the peoples, and it says all the peoples, nations and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image. Put yourself in that situation. You can imagine the pressure, can't you? The pressure to conform. Well, do you think the three friends turned up, or did they stay away? We're not told, are we? But if they attended, imagine what a bold move it would have been in that situation to remain on your feet when everybody else was flat on their faces. You would have really stood out. Pretty conspicuous. If they'd stayed away, well, that in itself took a fair bit of bottle, didn't it, when the king had commanded that they should turn up. It's hard, isn't it, going against the flow. It's hard being the odd person out. From our earliest days, even at school, maybe even at primary school, we felt this need to be accepted, the need to feel included. Being a servant of the Lord is hard, isn't it, because it means going against the flow in our beliefs and in our behaviour. We read in verse 8 that therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and they maliciously accused the Jews. Why did they do it? We've every indication that these Jews lived exemplary lives, but they'd made enemies. It could be from verse 12 that these Chaldeans, they were jealous of the promotions that the Jews had been given. But whatever the reason, these three friends face antagonism, malicious accusation. It's part of the cost of going against the flow. People don't like it, do they? As Paul warned in in 1 Timothy 3:12. He said, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Last Sunday was an anniversary, wasn't it? It was the 17th anniversary of... Last Sunday, 17th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. Do you remember the iconic image of the lone student standing in front of the tanks? You remember that iconic image standing in front of the three huge tanks in their path, refusing to move? He became known subsequently simply as the Tank Man. Everyone knew what you meant, the Tank Man. Well, that is pretty serious going against the flow, isn't it, to do that? That young man did it for democracy. That's why he did it. Are we prepared to do it for the gospel, for the Lord's sake, in our beliefs, in our behaviour, in your office, in the staff room, on the ward? Part of counting the cost as a servant of the Lord is going against the flow. But secondly, it also involved going into the flames. Going into the flames. So Daniel 3, it's not just about a golden image. It's also about the fiery furnace. So the fiery furnace gets its first mention in verse 6 with this proclamation at the dedication service. Whoever doesn't fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. So no messing about there. It's pretty serious stuff. The fiery furnace is mentioned another 9 times, and it's the focus of the rest of this chapter. The threat there was no idle threat, was it? When the king hears of their refusal to comply, we read in verse 13, he's hopping mad. He's in a furious rage. And he repeats the threat to them again in verse 15. If you don't worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. But our three heroes, our three guys, are not fazed at all, are they? Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we've no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we won't serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. It's pretty plucky stuff, isn't it? I mean, just note that they know that God has the power to deliver them. But at this stage, they don't know that's going to happen. They've no guarantee at all that he's going to deliver them. They are prepared to die. They're prepared to be burnt alive for the Lord's sake. They would rather die than compromise as servants of the Lord. I don't know what you make of that, but accounts like this are meant to inspire us. That's why it's here, to inspire us. When people read a story of some woman who sails around the world single-handed, they don't think, oh, I could never do that. You know, it's so remote from my experience, it's completely irrelevant. No, they devour the book. They think it's fascinating. And the courage of the woman inspires them to push back the boundaries in their own little situation, at work or at home or wherever. And so these accounts here of servants of the Lord suffering for him in ways that we probably never will, it's meant to inspire us. In the Barnabas Fund prayer diary, today's entry asks for prayer for Christians in a district of Sri Lanka. It says that in one town, a mob of 500 people surrounded a church during Sunday worship, and they demanded that they stop meeting there for services. Imagine that. Imagine that happening on the barge. But when we read of Christians being prepared to suffer for Christ in that sort of way, it should inspire us to count the cost ourselves. The price that we have to pay, it's tiny, it's pathetic in comparison, isn't it? But don't worry. Don't worry about whether you would stand firm if a death threat was hanging over your head. Don't worry about that. Instead, be inspired to show courage in standing for Christ tomorrow morning. 11 o'clock tomorrow morning in the office on the ward, be inspired to show courage in that situation. Incidentally, the fact that these three men were prepared to die for their beliefs doesn't make their beliefs true, does it? Yeah, the fact that you're prepared to die for something doesn't mean what you're prepared to die for is right and true. It means you're sincere, but you could be on the wrong path, although very sincere, and 9/11 is evidence enough of that, isn't it? So that the truth of a belief has got to be tested by other means. But anyway, those then are the two hallmarks of the servant of the Lord: refusing to serve other gods and resolving to count the cost. And it's a challenge to us today as God's people in exile to be inspired to follow their example. But secondly, and more briefly in this chapter, there is a reassurance that the Lord will be faithful to us. So we've had the call to be faithful to him as his servants. That is complemented by this reassurance that the Lord will be faithful to us. What form will God's faithfulness to us take? So how did the Lord show his faithfulness to these servants here in this chapter? Two things. Firstly, the Lord was with them in the fire. He was with them in the fire. Because of their refusal to worship other gods, we read that the king in verse 19 was filled with fury. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. So you can imagine the temperature gauge on the side of the furnace was through the red zone and going off the scale. In verse 20, he gets some of the biggest meatheads in the army to tie them up, to throw them into the flames. It's so hot that in verse 22, the military meatheads are killed, they're burnt up because they get too close. But then King Nebuchadnezzar has the shock of his little life. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" And they answered and said, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." 3 men thrown in bound into the flames. 4 men are seen walking in the flames unbound, as if they're just going through for a stroll in the park on a summer's day, completely unhurt by the flames. Who is this mystery 4th figure? Well, verse 25, the king describes him as like a son of the gods. Verse 28, as God's angel. In some shape or form, it must have been God himself with them in the flames. So whether God himself or through his angel that he sent, the point is that he was with them. He was protecting them. So God is faithful to them, not by keeping them from the flames, but by being with them in the flames. Very striking, isn't it? Very striking. If God had wanted, he could have stopped them going into the flames in the first place, couldn't he? He could have stopped these 3 men being thrown in the first place if he'd wanted. He's got that sort of power, hasn't he? If you were here last week, chapter 2, we saw God's power demonstrated on the international stage in the rise and fall of world empires. Well, with that sort of power at his command, God could easily have ensured that his servants were kept out of the furnace. But instead, God uses his power to protect them during their time in the furnace. Very important this, because it illustrates a biblical principle. God does not promise to keep us from trials, but he promises to be with us in the trials. Very important. God doesn't promise to keep us from trials, but to be with us in the trials. Remember way back in Exodus 3 verse 12, God had promised Moses, "I will be with you." And that promise is a thread running through the pages of Scripture and through the lives of God's people. What does David say in Psalm 23? I'm sure you all know it off by heart. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? "Because you are with me." What are the last words of Jesus to his disciples? Yes, they would face lots of troubles in this world, but Matthew 28, verse 20, "Behold, I am with you always to the end of the age." Such an important principle for us as Christians today, that God has not promised to keep us from trials, from hardships, but he has promised to be with us in them. So when things go wrong in our lives, in inverted commas, when they go wrong, God has not let us down. He's not failed us. He's not stopped being faithful. We should expect that disappointments and difficulties will come our way. So whether specifically because of our stand for Christ as Christians, or whether just as part and parcel of life in a fallen world, Christians get ill. Christians die. Some Christians die young, very young. Christians experience heartache in relationships going wrong and so on. We shouldn't be surprised when these things happen. But God promises to be with us in these times of trial. He will surround us with his protection and with his presence. He will never leave us or forsake us. The great evangelist, the great church leader, David Watson, described his own struggle with cancer in a book that he wrote shortly before his death from that disease. And the title of the book sums up this perspective. It's simply called Fear No Evil. Taken from Psalm 23, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, because you're with me. Many Christians operate with an unspoken assumption. And I think the assumption is this, that if I am faithful to the Lord, things are going to work out in my life. If I'm faithful to the Lord, things will work out in my life. And I think deep down personally, that is my default setting, if I'm honest. But that basic equation owes more to wishful thinking than to biblical understanding. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous because if troubles do come our way, how are we likely to respond? We're likely to become bitter towards God. We feel let down by him. We feel disillusioned. But 80 happy years, free of illness, 80 years of enjoying blissful marriage with 2.4 healthy children, that is not something God has promised to his people. What he has promised is to walk with us in the flames and to protect us. But you might be thinking, well, why doesn't he keep us from the trials in the first place? Let me just give you one cross-reference to turn to. Just one this evening, and 1 Peter 4, verse 12, to turn to. On page 1222. You'll see how Peter picks up the image from this chapter in Daniel chapter 3. 1 Peter 4, verse 12, Peter writes, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial, when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you." So notice the image he picks up there, fiery trial. Perhaps he was thinking of Daniel chapter 3 when he wrote those words. And he says it is to test you. To test you. Turn back to chapter 1 of 1 Peter in verse 7. Chapter 1 verse 7. Peter speaks of the tested genuineness of your faith. The tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire. So he's saying that God can use trials, he can use hardships to strengthen our faith and our character, to refine it like gold. Using the same fire imagery in Isaiah 48 verse 10, don't turn to it, but Isaiah 48:10, God says to his people, "Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tried you in the furnace of affliction." Now that isn't a complete explanation of why God allows suffering and hardships, but it is an important piece of the jigsaw. This perspective was essential for the exiles in Daniel's day to hold on to. These people of God, for whom the ordeal of exile was a fiery furnace. That's what the exile was like for them. It was a furnace. In fact, the first exile in Egypt was referred to using this same picture of a furnace. Deuteronomy 4:20 says, "The Lord has brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt." Well, these people needed to be reassured by God that he would be with them. He would be with them in the fiery furnace of exile in Babylon, and he would protect them. That is an essential perspective for exiles in this world, that God will be with us and he will use the trials, the hardships we go through for our spiritual and our eternal good. But secondly and finally, God's faithfulness to these three servants was seen in that the Lord brought them through the fire as well. He brought them through the fire. Verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together. And they saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads wasn't singed, their cloaks weren't harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. You see, God wasn't just with them in the flames. He also brought them out of the flames completely unharmed. The military meatheads, they'd been incinerated. The servants of God, they didn't even smell of smoke. Amazing. What a miraculous escape. What a deliverance. As Psalm 34 verse 7 says, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. However, throughout church history, many servants of God have faced the flames, literally, in being tied to a stake and burned, but they haven't been delivered. They did die. For them, there was no miraculous escape. I mean, just think of the Reformation martyrs like Ridley, Latimer. Why didn't God deliver them in the way that he delivered these three friends? Well, he did deliver them. He did deliver them. It's just that in their case, he delivered them not from death, but he delivered them through death. Yeah, you get this idea in Philippians 1 verse 19, don't turn to it, but where Paul says as he faces possible death, he says it will turn out for his deliverance, whether by life or by death. Likewise, 2 Timothy 4:18, Paul speaks of being rescued and being brought safely into God's heavenly kingdom. So you see the point. Although the three servants in Daniel, they were delivered from the flames on that occasion, one day they would have had to have died. That would have happened one day. But as he brought them through the fiery furnace, so he would bring them through that trial and through the coming judgment and into his kingdom. And you see the point that it's the same with us, that is what God promises us too. That we will emerge unscathed on the other side. Seems impossible, doesn't it? Humanly speaking, it is impossible. But God asks us to trust him as we one day face death ourselves. And when we do that, when we trust God, we actually join the ranks of those in Hebrews 11 verse 34. Those believers who, it said, through faith quench the power of fire. One day God would bring his people out of the fiery trial of exile in Babylon to the promised land. And so one day God will bring us too, as his people, he'll bring us out of the fiery trial of exile in this world and safely into his kingdom. What a reassurance this is, that the Lord will be faithful to us in these ways. It's a reassurance for his people. What about those who are not God's servants? Many hundreds of years after Daniel 3 was written, Jesus himself warns about another fiery furnace. Matthew 13:49, Jesus says that at the end of the age, the angels will come out and they will separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place, he says, there will be weeping and there will be gnashing of teeth. The fiery furnace of hell, of eternal judgment, of what Revelation 20 verse 15 refers to as the lake of fire. And unlike the furnace in Daniel 3, there's no deliverance from it once you've entered it, and there's no presence of God in it to comfort you when you're there. Instead, as Jesus says, it's a place of weeping, a place of gnashing of teeth, a place of eternal loss, eternal regret, and eternal separation from God. And that is why God calls on everyone now, while there's yet time, to turn to him, to turn to him from idols, to serve the living and true God, and to wait for his Son from heaven, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. Well, let's pause just for a moment to reflect on everything we've heard from this chapter. And in the quietness of our hearts and minds, let's respond to God in prayer before Richard continues to lead us.